Okay, good morning, everybody. Bio 241, and we're talking about muscle, so we're in the muscle chapter. And next time we don't have a lecture, we got exam. Okay, exam 3. What chapters is that exam on? 9, 10, and 11. So it's what? Autonomic nervous system. Got to know different kinds of receptors, and then we have senses. Right, and then we have endocrinology. Those are the three chapters. So you all know where to find those materials, but if you don't, probably too late. So hopefully you've been looking at the materials already. Yeah, question. Yeah, there's a couple like that. You should probably maybe see me after class or during office hour or something like that, but usually the answer is kind of obvious which one is correct, but you know what, I try to refrain from questions like that on the unless I've gone over it specifically in class. Okay, yeah, but it's kind of interesting to think about, and it's good to for you to develop a perspective and an understanding of those questions. Okay, so it's actually great that you're catching that. Okay, so I probably won't put a question like that exactly on the test unless I've gone over it. Okay. Okay, so on Thursday, what's real important to bring to class? Yeah, eraser, please, a good eraser, and don't get carried away marking up your Scantron. All right, and if you'd make an eraser, make sure it's nice and clean. Don't smudge things up. Okay. All right, so who's got any question on the on muscles at all? Questions on muscles? So far, so good. All right, well, I still want to review just a little bit on muscles, make sure we're all right on the same page, but maybe you went back and reviewed some of your anatomy. But let's make sure we understand what the building blocks of the muscle or a muscle, the organ is. All right, so here is an organ, and muscle is an organ. Why? Yeah, it's got different kinds of tissues. For instance, it's got connective tissue. It's got the connective tissue coverings like the epimysium. It's got connective tissue because blood is going through. It's got nervous tissue because there's nerves in there. And, of course, it's muscle tissue. That's another kind of tissue. All right, so what is the basic building block of the organ? Well, if you look inside, you see things are compartmentalized. So these very large compartments that you can see with your naked eye are called... What are those compartments called? They're called sometimes bundles, but a more proper name would be a fascicle. So a building block of a whole muscle are these fascicles right here. And fascicles are made up of building blocks. What are the building blocks of a fascicle? They are the muscle fibers or muscle cells. And remember, muscle, and these are skeletal muscles, of course. Muscle cells are very long and linear. They're not branched whatsoever, right? And they were composed of thousands of cells at one time that have all fused together. So what can you tell me about the number of nuclei in one muscle fiber or cell? It has a lot, right? It's multinucleate because a cell usually only has one nucleus. We're going to see that there's another cell that doesn't have any nucleus in it whatsoever, but a muscle fiber has many because it was many cells at one time. All right, and then what is the building block, a basic building block of a muscle fiber? The myofibril. And what is the function of a myofibril? It's the organelle for contraction. So it's an organelle, it's a subcellular organelle, and that's what gives skeletal muscle its striated appearance. So you can see these striations back and forth. So if we look at a muscle cell, so here's a cell within a fascicle. All right, there are many myofibrils, and these are what? Long and narrow. They're not branched either, and they have this repeated pattern over and over again, some dark bands and light bands that repeat from one end of the muscle cell to the other. And notice that these light and dark bands line up between different myofibrils within a fiber. They all line up exactly in the same location. And these dark and light bands even line up with neighboring muscle cells. So the whole muscle is lined up properly with these light and dark bands so that when you look at it, underneath a microscope, it's very clear to see these striations. Okay, and so here are the myofibrils, the organelles for contraction, and myofibrils have components as well. They have building blocks. What are the two main components of a myofibril? Yeah, you see the filaments right here, or you could call these myofilaments. Furthermore, you should know the names of these myofilaments. They are actin and myosin, and which one is the thick one? Myosin, and then there's a thin one that is actin. Right. Okay, so that's how you put together a muscle, with put myofilaments together to get a myofibril, which is the contracting organelle. And you put a bunch of myofibrils together, you get a muscle cell or fiber. You put a bunch of muscle cells or fibers together, you get a fascicle. And then if you put a bunch of fascicles together, you get the whole muscle, as long as you can add some connective tissue, right, and nerve supply to it. Okay. All right, so that's a muscle. And then notice the striations in this nice micrograph right here. And that's just due to the arrangement of those myofilaments within the myofibril. And I think we talked about the neuromuscular junction last time, okay? So that was, what, that's the structural and functional unit of communication between a neuron and a muscle cell. And we're going to look a little bit more in detail. This is like any kind of regular chemical synapse, except that when this axon terminus excites the muscle tries to pull away from this neuron because a muscle is specialized to contract. So there have to be additional proteins that make sure that the muscle can't pull away from the axon terminus. All right, so there's a little bit more structure in this neuromuscular junction. The other thing is that there are, well, let me ask you, what's the neurotransmitter that's used at the neuromuscular junction? Yeah, and what's the receptor? It's a cholinergic receptor, but of what type? Okay, what are the two types? You got to know this by Thursday. You got nicotinic and muscarinic receptors for acetylcholine. What kind do you have here in the neuromuscular junction? Nicotinic, so it's just purely a sodium channel that opens when acetylcholine binds to it. All right, and so the axon terminals are huge compared to a regular neuron-neuron synapse. Right, and the number of nicotinic receptors is large, relatively speaking. So when an action potential reaches the axon terminus, it causes a massive depolarization of the neuromuscular junction always. And then also within the neuromuscular junction and very close, you have voltage-gated channels. So as soon as this area depolarizes, that sets up another action potential on the surface of the muscle cell because of those voltage-gated channels. So in every case, when there's an action potential on the axon terminus, that's going to produce an action potential on the sarcolemma, which is the plasma membrane of the muscle cell, in every case. So the muscle cell can never decide whether it's going to contract or not, because skeletal muscle is under what kind of control? Voluntary control. As soon as you give the command to contract, that's going to cause contraction of whatever muscles you want to contract, because the muscle can't decide, no, I don't want to contract, because of the number of nicotinic receptors and the relationship to those voltage-gated channels. Now, you can remember in a neuron, those voltage-gated channels are remote, right? Where do you first run into voltage-gated channels? Nowhere near the synapse, but not until you get way to the axon hillock, right, the trigger zone. That's not true with muscle, right? The voltage-gated channels are right here by the neuromuscular junction. So it always contracts. Okay, and motor unit we talked about last time, and I think that's pretty much about where we were, where we stopped, the motor unit. Okay, so this is where we started today, looking at a muscle fiber. Another name for a muscle fiber is a muscle cell. Building blocks are the contractile organelles called myofibrils. Myofibrils are made up of these myofilaments, and you can see that they're all lined up together. All right, so we see some dark bands, and the dark bands within the myofibrils have one of the myofilaments in them, the thick one, so it blocks a lot of light. So these are myosin filaments right here. And the light bands have the very thin filaments in them, so they don't block a lot of light that's shining through them. So they look a lot lighter. All right, and you can see that there is a repeating pattern of these. You can also see a couple of very narrow, exceptionally dark lines. Like here's one right here, and there's one right here. That's a very important distinction for you to be able to see, because this defines the structural and functional unit of contraction. And if you understand how this unit contracts between these very thin dark lines, you understand how the whole myofibril shortens. And if you understand how a myofibril shortens, you understand how all of the myofibril shorten, or how the whole muscle cell shortens, right? So the only thing we've got to be really concerned about is what's happening between these two very narrow dark lines right here. So if you're going to pick a letter of the alphabet to designate the endpoints for something, guess what letter you might pick? The Z. That's right. So these are the Z lines or Z discs, because it goes all the way through the myofibril right here. So it's really a three-dimensional structure. And which protein is attached to the Z disc? Is it a thick one or a thin one? Okay. Well, I have the cursor right on the Z disc. And what's attaching to it? Okay. Does that look thicker, for instance, than this one right here? It's supposed to actually be thinner. Okay, so the protein that's attached to the Z disc is the actin molecule. And then floating in the middle right here is the myosin molecule. Because remember, the myosin makes for that very dark band, and the actin makes for a very light band. All right, so what do we call these bands? The light band that we see goes on either side from one sarcomere to the other, we call that the I band. All right, so that's pretty easy to remember, because when you spell out light, what does that mean? What do you have in there? You've got an I. That's not how it was named, but that's an easy way to remember it. All right, and then here is the dark band from here all the way over to here. All right, and guess what we call that band? That is the A band. I don't know if you memorized that in anatomy, but you probably should have. And that's easy to remember, because there's an A in dark, and we call it the A band. That's not really why we call it the A band, and there's a different scientific reason for it, because of the way polarized light is bent through these two different regions of skeletal muscle. But this is the A band, and then here is the I band. And the structural and functional unit of contraction between these two Z discs is what we call the sarcomere. Right? So that's a really important consideration for yourself, to make sure you know that, because you know a lot of structural and functional units in this class. Like, for instance, the structural functional unit of life is a cell, right? All right. And for contraction, it's just going to be the sarcomere. So we got to know a lot about that sarcomere in order to know how a muscle contracts. Okay. So a little bit better illustration of a sarcomere. Here we see that Z disc and a Z disc over here that defines the sarcomere. And we can see the thick filaments in the middle, which are the myosin filaments, and the thin ones that are the actin that actually attach to the Z discs. All right. In the very center, where we don't have actin, all right, because it's not long enough to overlap, there's another zone called the H zone, which kind of looks relatively light, all right, but not as light as the I band right here. And we see some other proteins that are attached to myosin that hold the myosin right smack in the middle of the sarcomere. So sometimes this is called the M line, and that M stands for middle. You can say myosin, that's okay. But that M, I would say, stands for middle, like metaphase, right? That just means the middle phase of mitosis. Okay, M for middle, which is right in the middle of the H zone over here. Okay, so you can see that the actin is actually made up of hundreds of tiny little globular proteins, little balls that are connected together, right? The myosin is more tubular in nature, right? It has more threads that make it up that all run parallel to each other, but it also has something poking out of it. So the myosin has these structures poking up off the surface, and these are what we call head groups. And the head groups actually can attach themselves under proper conditions to actin, and that's going to cause a shortening of the sarcomere. So when a sarcomere shortens, it's just that the Z lines come closer together, or they approximate each other. So a good question you should be thinking to yourself right now would be, well, if a whole muscle shortens because the muscle fibers shorten, and the muscle fibers shorten because the myofibrils get shorter, and the myofibrils get shorter because these sarcomeres get shorter, you might say, well, gee whiz, which of these proteins gets shorter when the sarcomere gets shorter? Right? Which one of these proteins actually gets shorter when a muscle contracts? Another way of looking at that. So you don't have to answer that right now, but you could if you wanted to. Let's investigate this just a little bit further. All right, so here is a little bit more of a three-dimensional view of what is happening. One of these figures is an exam figure. I'm not exactly sure which one it is. So you got to know all the different bands and zones and things like that in the Z-disc. All right, so just remember the dark band is where you have myosin and the light band is where you don't have myosin within a sarcomere. Okay. And of course, then here is the Z-disc. And so if we make a cut through a myofibril and look at it on edge, like if we're going to look right down into a myofibril, this is what it looks like. Right? And so do you see any kind of nifty pattern right here? Can you see myosin and actin in this micrograph, in this cross-section of a myofibril? All right, so where I have the cursor, let me get the cursor. I can't zoom in. Can't blow it up. How about, right there. Ooh, I moved. Okay, right there. There. I can't talk, but I have to ask you a question. What protein does that look like at the tip of that cursor? Who wants to guess? I heard one guess. Do I hear any other good guesses? Myosin, yeah, because it looks thick, right? It looks thick. So that's a myosin protein. And what is surrounding this myosin protein, these little dots, what are the little dots? Those are the actin proteins. So surrounding every myosin is what? Actin molecules. So myosin is completely surrounded in a three-dimensional view by actin. And if we look at an actin molecule right here, what is it surrounded by? It's surrounded by myosin. So they surround each other in a three-dimensional sense, right? All right, so but where are we looking? We're looking in this region right here, some part of the A band that has both actin and myosin in order to see them both. So they interdigitate, they overlap, and they completely surround each other. So there must be some important association between these two kinds of proteins within the sarcomere. Okay, so here's a really good example of a sarcomere. And again, you can see the endpoints, the Z discs very clearly, the dark band, which we call A band, and then the light band is right here, okay? And here's the M line right smack in the middle of the sarcomere, right in the middle of the H zone. But we see another protein, and this right here is what we call chitin. So myosin is just not floating inside the sarcomere, but it is also attached to the Z discs and held in place loosely by this chitin filament. And the chitin filament is not associated with contraction at all. You see that it's kind of wound up. It looks like a spring. And so this chitin molecule really does have elasticity and extensibility. And maybe when you took anatomy, you remember that that is two important properties of muscle, right? It has to be extensible and it's elastic. Because, for instance, my triceps right here compared to my biceps, if I contract my biceps, what does the triceps have to do? It's got to extend, right? And when I relax my arm, what happens to my tricep? It shortens because of the elastic properties of this chitin molecule. So chitin is pretty important, but more for the passive properties of muscle, not for developing tension. Okay, and so you can see it helps keep myosin in its right place. All right, so that's all of the proteins, and here you can see the myosin head group. This is going to form something that we call a cross bridge. So the myosin head group can actually form a bridge. It can reach up and grab hold of this actin molecule, which is what we're going to look at next. Okay. So how does a muscle fiber contract? That's the muscle cell. Okay. Muscles contract because myofibrils get shorter. This occurs because the thin filaments slide over and between the thick filaments towards the center. And when that happens, the distance between the two Z discs get shorter. The two Z discs get pulled together. So here we have a couple of electron micrographs of a muscle when it's at rest, muscle when it's partially contracted, and then muscle when it is fully contracted, and then here's a corresponding illustration underneath it. All right, so here we can see the light bands when it's relaxed, and we can see the dark band when the muscle is relaxed, and there's a little bit even of this H zone, right, when the muscle is relaxed. Well, when it starts to contract, all right, and can you tell that there's contraction taking place? How do you know contraction is taking place? So if we look at this middle micrograph, how do you know contraction is taking place? Yeah, because look at the Z disc. Right in the middle is a Z disc, so that's going to be held stationary, and then all we have to do is look at the distance from the Z disc over to the other end of the sarcomere. And so we can see in the middle case right here, this muscle is actually contracting because these Z discs are coming closer to each other. So the muscle is contracting. All right, and even on this figure, what can you tell me about this I band on the top compared to the middle figure right here? The middle figure is it wider or more narrow? Yeah. It's more narrow. It's actually disappearing. All right, the same thing for the H zone. It is disappearing. Right. And then let's look at a case where the muscle is fully contracted. What band actually disappears? The H band goes away, right? There's no, it's all dark all the way through here, but what about the I band? That one disappears as well. All right, so what that says is that when a sarcomere contracts, you never have an area inside the sarcomere that doesn't contain what's contained in the dark band right here. The A band, myosin. So when a sarcomere contracts, the whole sarcomere is filled up with myosin from end to end. All right, so how can we explain this? All right, so let's look at the illustration. Okay, so if we look at an actin molecule when the muscle is relaxed and compare the length of this actin to when it is partially contracted, can you see any change in length from number 1 to number 2 for actin? Actin looks like it's the same length. Now what about when the muscle is fully contracted? And of course it's contracting because the Z discs are coming together. Let's look at the length of this actin compared to the length of this actin right here. It is what? It looks the same. All right, so actin is not, we can't use actin to explain how a sarcomere shortens because actin doesn't shorten. So that must mean what? That maybe myosin is shortening. So let's look at the length of myosin. So here is myosin from here to here, and when the muscle is partially contracted, what can you tell me about the length of myosin? It looks the same. Well, let's look when the muscle is fully contracted. What's the length of myosin? It's the same. So we can't invoke myosin shortening for muscle contraction, right? And so we can't rely on actin shortening either. So neither of these proteins actually shorten when the sarcomere shortens. All right, but when you look at this, how can you explain what's going on? Look at the degree of overlap between actin and myosin. Very little overlap when it's relaxed. There's a moderate amount of overlap when it's partially contracted. And then the myosin right here is completely overlapped by actin when the muscle is fully contracted. All right, so that's why we call this the sliding filament mechanism for muscle contraction. So these filaments don't shorten, they just do what when a muscle contracts? They just slide over each other. So if you think of my two hands as being the Z discs on a muscle, and these two markers being actin and myosin, I just put them together so I don't drop them. Okay. How can my hands get closer together if the myosin and actin don't get any shorter? They can just slide over the top of each other like this. Right, so now my hands have come a lot closer together, but has the length of either of these markers changed? No, they just slide over each other. So that's how muscle contraction takes place. We use the sliding filament model or theory to explain how a sarcomere shortens. And don't forget, it's not just this one sarcomere, it's what? All the thousands of sarcomeres that make up a myofibril, and then all the scores of myofibrils that make up a muscle fiber. All right, and then of course you have many muscle fibers that make up a muscle, and that develops a tremendous amount of tension for contraction. All right, so I think this is basically what I talked about already, so I'm not going to read this to you, but you probably want to read over that sometime. All right, so how is it that these filaments really slide over each other? We have to look at some other little mechanisms. So let's really zoom in to the proteins, the myofilaments, and here is the thick filament, which is what? Which one? myosin, and of course you can see the head groups sticking up off of it, and then here is the actin filament or the thin filament, and you can see the globular proteins that make up the actin. The myosin proteins are more filamentous in nature, more like rods. Okay, and the head group has a couple parts to it. The head group has an active site that can bind ATP, and it can hydrolyze ATP. So this is what we call an ATPase. So this is the part of myosin that can actually access the energy that is contained, the chemical energy that's contained in ATP, and it releases it by hydrolysis. There's another important part to the head group, and that is the actin binding site. See this little bulge right here, right on the top of the head group right here? All right, so that's the actin binding site, which means that the head group can actually, under the right circumstances, can bind to a globular actin molecule. So there has to be a corresponding binding site for myosin on an actin molecule. And they're hidden at the moment because they're underneath this long molecule right here that we call tropomyosin. So that binding site is hidden on the actin molecule. All right, the other thing that you notice on this slide is that this myosin head can change conformation, right? It can be in this flex configuration. Maybe think of this as being an elbow right here or a knuckle on your finger, all right? But it can also use the energy in ATP to extend the head group. And here we see the head group extended. So it can flip back and forth between these two states with the use of energy from ATP. Okay. All right. So when ATP is hydrolyzed, that then gives you ADP and inorganic phosphate. All right. And when this joint right here articulates, or you could call it flex, when it flexes, when the head group is bound to this actin molecule, when it flexes, guess what happens to the actin molecule? It slides over the top of the myosin. All right. Now don't forget, where do you have these head groups on a myosin molecule? Everywhere, 360 degrees around the myosin molecule, right? And where do you have actin? Complete 360 degrees around the myosin. So when actin starts to slide over myosin, it's not just due to this one head group, but to what? Thousands of head groups in all directions completely surrounding the myosin. So the sarcomere develops a tremendous amount of force in doing that. Okay, let's look at actin. A couple other components for actin we want to be concerned about. So actin is made up of these globular units, but it also has a very long protein associated with it, and that's called tropomyosin. Tropomyosin, when the muscle is at rest, is covering up the binding sites for the myosin head group right here. So when tropomyosin is in this position, that's not going to allow cross-bridge cycling, which is what is going to produce sliding of the actin and myosin filaments over each other. All right, there has to be a mechanism by which tropomyosin is pulled out of the way to reveal the binding sites for the myosin head group. And that involves this other molecule that we see, and this is what we call troponin. And troponin is related to another compound you're already familiar with, and that was calmodulin. What does calmodulin interact with? Calcium, that's right. When calcium binds to calmodulin, it causes a conformation change, which maybe activates or inactivates an enzyme, which changes metabolism inside the cell. Well, when calcium binds to troponin, so troponin is like a cousin molecule to calmodulin, they're related to each other. When it binds calcium, it changes conformation, which then changes the conformation of tropomyosin, and it pulls it out of the way so that the binding site for myosin becomes revealed and the cross bridge can form. All right, so calcium is the signal that allows myosin to bind to actin. All right, so think of troponin as like a calmodulin molecule. Now, how are you going to remember that troponin is this small molecule over here that binds calcium, and tropomyosin is this big long one that covers up the binding sites? Does anybody see an easy way to remember that? Or maybe you guys are really good at memorizing or something, but I like to have little tricks sometime. How are you going to remember that troponin binds calcium and tropomyosin is the big long molecule that covers up all the binding sites. Well, when I look at it, I see tropomyosin is what? The really big long word compared to troponin. And so that corresponds to the really big long protein that covers up the binding sites. I know, don't tell anybody I tell you all these things. But you know what? You might remember that in a couple years. All right, so that's okay. So don't forget, troponin works like calmodulin. And so the ATPase in the myosin head right here is a fast ATPase. It can release a lot of energy in a hurry. And remember, there's different kinds of muscle tissue in your body. What are all the classes of muscle tissue in your body? Smooth, cardiac, and skeletal. And smooth muscle is very slow, right? It can sustain a contraction for a long period of time, but it contracts very slowly because of this ATPase, right? And smooth muscle is a slow kind. And remember, different enzymes can be made in different isozymes, different forms that have a little bit different activity, perform the same function, but maybe at a little bit different rate. So the isozyme that you have in smooth muscle is just a lot slower, so smooth muscle contracts more slowly, even when it's optimal conditions. It can't contract fast. Yeah.
So the head, once the head's attached to the action, is that
going
to pull the
action? Yeah, I got a couple more slides. Okay, so this is just an introduction to what's going on. I got two more real important slides to look at. Okay, so this is just the components. You get the myosin head group, and the tail. The head and tail come together to form a cross bridge when it binds to actin. And also on the head group, you got two important sites. You got the actin binding site, but also the ATPase, which has what, an ATP binding site. But I see a question. Yeah, troponin can bind. There is a site on troponin which can bind calcium. Right, so there is an active site on troponin that can bind calcium. And when it does, that causes a conformation change in troponin, but troponin is also connected to tropomyosin. And so when troponin changes shape, that changes the shape of tropomyosin. So remember, there's always a relationship between structure and function. When something binds to a molecule, that's going to change its structure, and that's going to lead to a change in function as well. And that's what's going to allow the actin binding site on myosin to attach itself to the myosin binding site on actin. Should I say that again one more time? That's sort of like anatomy, looking at the zygomatic process a little bit. Okay. All right. So when calcium binds to troponin, tropomyosin moves out of the way so that the actin binding site on myosin can bind to the myosin binding site on actin. Okay? So it's a little wordy, but if my recorder's working, you should be able to replay it. All right. So let's move on to the next slide. So here is an important part of cross-bridge cycling, or having the filaments slide over each other, and this is what we call the power stroke. All right, so we see in this particular case that the myosin head group is attached to actin, all right, and we'll talk about that, how that happens in just a little bit. And the myosin binding site for ATP has already hydrolyzed ATP and converted it into ADP and inorganic phosphate, and has extended the head group, so it's been cocked. We call that cocking or extending the head group. And then when inorganic phosphate leaves the binding site on the myosin head, guess what happens to the conformation of this cross bridge? It changes. It turns into this flexed conformation right here. All right, and when it flexes and it's grabbing hold of an actin molecule, what happens to the actin? It gets pulled over the surface of the myosin molecule. So this actin, okay, it just slides over. It moves from this position to about this position when, okay, during a process that we call the power stroke for the myosin head group. All right, so can you see a change in conformation from here to here? And when that conformation change occurs, actin gets pulled over the myosin molecule. The myosin is fixed where? Right in the middle of the sarcomere. Where is the actin fixed? It's fixed to, what's it attached to? Can you remember where the actin is attached to? What part of the sarcomere? It's attached to the Z discs, right? And so when actin gets pulled to the center of the sarcomere, what happens to the Z discs? They get pulled to the center of the sarcomere as well because the actin molecule is attached to it. So what I want you to know is a definition of the power stroke. That happens when, what happens? When inorganic phosphate is released. We call that the power stroke. Okay. All right, so here is the whole cycle right here. And maybe let's just start on step number 5. All right, maybe this is a good place to start. So we see that. Yeah.
So where does the ADP come from?
I'm going to tell you that right now. Where does ADP come from? It comes from ATP. So here's an ATP that is now bound to the active site of the ATPase in the myosin head group. And what is ATPase going to do? It's going to hydrolyze ATP into ADP and inorganic phosphate. And then what's left over? What's left over when you have ATP going to ADP plus inorganic phosphate, you have, don't forget, of that other kind of more nebulous kind of entity, but it's still there, that is energy. Energy is released when ATP is hydrolyzed, and that energy can be used for something to do work. And what work is it going to do? It's going to cause a conformation change in the head group. So now the head group extends itself. Can you see it now reaching out? It's extended, it straightens out. And when it straightens out, okay, that's when it can bind to an actin binding site, when it straightens out. So it binds to an actin binding site, all right? And then, so we get down to this position right here, and then inorganic phosphate leaves. What happens when inorganic phosphate leaves? Then it goes through the power stroke. So then we're down over here when it goes through the power stroke. And then after the power stroke takes place, this is the guy that leaves. What is this? This is ADP, right? So ADP can leave the active site, and since the active site is now empty, what can come in? ATP can come in, and when ATP comes in, right, that's going to cause the release of the myosin head group from actin. Right, so ATP is necessary for the release of myosin from actin. So we get to this position right here. ATP is still in the binding site, and then when ATP is hydrolyzed, that causes the conformation change in the head group. And when the conformation change takes place, then myosin can bind to another location on the actin molecule. Right, but this is where the energy is used to cock that myosin head group, and this process can repeat itself over and over and over again, causing the actin to slide over the myosin molecule. And this can happen thousands of times a second for one myosin head group, but it is also happening for what? All of the myosin head groups or cross bridges within that myofibril, or actually within inside that whole muscle cell. So this is happening hundreds of thousands of times within a muscle fiber. Okay, so don't forget, the power stroke, right, is when the myosin is really pulling on the actin molecule, happens when inorganic phosphate is released. All right, what causes the release of myosin from actin? What molecule has to be there to cause the release? And if release doesn't occur, what's going to happen to muscle? It's going to stay contracted. What muscle is necessary to initiate the release of myosin from actin? What's this guy right here? You might want to draw that in. Yeah, that's ATP, right? So ATP actually prevents the what we call rigor mortis of muscle, right? Because when a cell dies, it can't produce ATP, right? And when a muscle cell can't produce ATP, it forms this latched state of contracted muscle, and of course that happens after death, and we call that rigor mortis for a certain period of time when everybody's skeletal muscles are contracted, okay, because there's no longer ATP to cause the release of myosin from actin. All right, and then the hydrolysis of ATP cocks the head group, and once it's cocked, it can bind to the actin molecule, and then when inorganic phosphate's released, it goes through the power stroke, And then when ATP binds again, it gets released. All right, so that process just kind of goes over and over and over again, maybe 1,000 times a second. Okay, so who had a question on that? Somebody had a question on that over here. Yeah, so does that kind of explain your question a little bit?
But I don't get it, like, when does it pull?
When does it pull? When it goes through the power stroke. Okay, so, I don't know, let me use something big. So let's just say that this ruler right here is actin, and my arm is myosin. All right, so when, okay, and let's just say that myosin is attached to actin. When can myosin let go of actin? When there's ATP, right, binding to the myosin head group, okay? All right, so, and then how can the myosin head, so the actin molecule is right about here, it gets released. When can the myosin get cocked again? Where does it get the energy to cause this conformation change, going to like an extended form? When ATP is hydrolyzed, all right? And then after ATP is hydrolyzed and myosin is extended, what can happen? It can attach to the actin once again. All right, so now we've got what? ADP and inorganic phosphate in the myosin head group. So now what does the head group do? It can go through another conformation change. It can flex like this, and look what happens to the actin molecule. It does what? It slides, it's moving over to your left. All right, and what causes this to happen? What causes the power, this is what we call the power stroke. What causes the power stroke? That's the release of inorganic phosphate, okay? And then ADP leaves, and ATP enters, what happens? It releases, okay? And then when ATP is hydrolyzed, it reaches out in front again and grabs to another actin, another spot on actin, and then another power stroke, and everything slides over again. But that happens thousands of times a second, okay? So who had that question? Yeah, so does that... It'd be nice to see a movie of that, actually. Okay. All right, so I can't remember. So this is a good figure to understand and try to break it down into those key components. All right, so let's talk about the control. Oh, well, this right here of attaching, reattaching, and going through these different conformation changes, this is what we call cross-bridge cycling. Cross-bridge cycling, so this is what a cycle. And this is what causes actin to slide over the myosin. So what controls cross-bridge cycling? Okay, the energy molecule is ATP, right? Because muscles got to have a lot of ATP. They have a lot of mitochondria. But that's not the signaling molecule. So when I think of control, I want to know what is the signal that allows myosin and actin to use ATP to slide over each other and develop tension, okay? Okay, so let's take a look. Inorganic phosphate causes the power stroke, but what's the signal that allows this whole process to happen, cross-bridge cycling? Okay, so this is under the heading of control of contraction, right? So control of cross-bridge attachment to actin is via troponin-tropomyosin system that we just previously told you about. So here is what? Does this look like myosin or what? That's the actin molecule with all the components drawn in, including the tropomyosin, the long tropomyosin molecule, and the troponin complex. And the binding sites for myosin are underneath the tropomyosin. They're hidden from view, and they're up over here and here and here. Right? Because remember, what's surrounding this actin molecule? It's surrounded by myosin, right? So there are binding sites everywhere around actin. All right, and so you can see the association of troponin to tropomyosin. What's a cousin molecule to troponin again? That is calmodulin, so it's going to want to bind calcium. All right, so in relaxed muscle, tropomyosin blocks the binding sites. As a matter of fact, I can't even see them under there right now because they're blocked so well, so that cross bridges can't attach. When calcium concentration is below about micromolar concentration, that's really, really, really dilute concentration, right? Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites and contraction can't occur. But as soon as calcium levels rise above that micromolar concentration, calcium binds to troponin, like we see down on this bottom picture over here. So calcium binds to troponin, and then that pushes tropomyosin out of the way. And so now, do you see this? Do you see the binding site that's covered up? And when tropomyosin moves out of the way, you see it right here. And now, what's associating with the myosin binding site? It is the actin binding site on myosin, and it has attached to the actin molecule. So now this cross bridge is formed as long as calcium can bind to troponin. And when calcium signal goes away, guess what happens? Then troponin blocks the binding sites and myosin can no longer bind, and that muscle is not going to be able to contract. All right, so only at higher levels of intracellular calcium can the cross bridge form. All right, so how does that happen? Well, let's look at something we call excitation-contraction coupling. All right, so here is a muscle cell, a very nice illustration of a muscle cell, and you can see that this muscle cell has many nuclei in it, typical of a skeletal muscle cell. It's linear, right? It's not branched, and it's also loaded with these guys. What are these guys right here and here? Okay, here's a nucleus. I can tell because it's blue, and these I can tell because they're red. Okay, they're mitochondria, right? They're mitochondria. What's the job of these mitochondria? Yeah, they're making ATP for sliding of these filaments for cross-bridge formation. Okay, but you also see a network surrounding all the myofibrils. So here's a myofibril. Oh, what's this thing from here to here called? Yeah, those are Z-discs, but what's in between the Z-discs? That's a sarcomere. That's the unit of contraction within this muscle. And then, of course, you see a nice A-band and I-band right here. But that network surrounding all the myofibrils, that's what we call sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, the cell membrane is what we call the sarcolemma. So anytime you hear that term sarco, you should think of skeletal muscle cell. All right, so the sarcoplasmic reticulum is really smooth endoplasmic reticulum, so it's not responsible for making proteins. It's responsible for, okay, for one of two things, lipid synthesis, remember, but that's not important in the muscle cell right here. It's important because it acts as a reservoir for calcium. So there are calcium pumps, proteins in the membrane of the sarcoplasmic reticulum that are continually using ATP and pumping calcium inside the reticulum, removing it from the sarcomeres. All right, so this object is filled with calcium. So if we put a hole in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, what would happen to calcium? It would rush out. Yeah, I would say maybe not even leak out. It would rush out because there's such a high concentration inside the sarcoplasmic reticulum. It would just rush out and flood the whole myofibril, and then that calcium would bind to troponin, move tropomyosin out of the way, right? And then the filaments can slide over each other. All right, so the sarcoplasmic reticulum kind of has like a little pinkish color to me. I don't know, what color is this right here, right where I have the cursor? Green? Blue. Green, blue, looks pink. I think we're all colorblind in there. Okay, how about aqua? Aqua? Green and blue, kind of a compromise. Okay, aqua. So the sarcoplasmic reticulum is aqua. All right, and then, but we see that there's a tube that's a different color between the reticulum, and I have no idea what color that is. We'll just say, what, beige? No, that's peach. You guys are having a lot of fun today. Okay. So the sarcolemma, all right, is loaded with voltage-gated channels, which means what? What can occur over the cell membrane right here, since it has voltage-gated channels? Action potentials, right? If it has voltage-gated channels, then it can propagate an action potential. And notice these holes right here. These are the entry points for the structure that goes all the way across the muscle cell. That's what we call a transverse tubule or a T-tubule. And there are voltage-gated channels in these T-tubules. And so what does that do? That propagates an action potential not only this over the surface of the muscle cell, but also down through these T-tubules. So action potentials go everywhere, even to the interior of the cell. All right, so now you can probably see that a muscle acts a lot like a neuron. because it has these voltage-gated channels, it can propagate action potential. Only neurons can't contract because they don't have myofibrils. All right, and those action potentials then trigger the release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, right, even through this whole network right here, and that's what is going to initiate sliding of the myofilaments that we just discussed so far. So if we see a T-tubule, and then these two parts of the sarcoplasmic reticulum, this is what we call a terminal cisternae of a sarcoplasmic reticulum, one on either side of the T-tubule, so I see these three structures right here, sometimes we call that a triad. All right, so that's an important step in coupling excitation of the cell membrane to what? Muscle contraction or sliding of the myofilaments. All right, so here is a nice zoomed in region of the different kinds of membrane proteins that we have. And so here we have a nice somatic motor neuron coming down from the spinal cord. We can see synaptic vesicles. So what is this structure right here that I'm circling? This is the... That's the neuromuscular junction, right? And so what's the neurotransmitter that's used right here? Acetylcholine. And then here are the receptors for acetylcholine. So what kind of receptors are these? These are just nicotinic type receptors. When acetylcholine binds, they open up and they allow sodium to enter, which is, what does that produce? Depolarization or an EPSP, right? That depolarizes these cells. And then right nearby, and even within the neuromuscular junction, there are voltage-gated channels, and they open up, they further depolarize the cell, right? So acetylcholine produces graded potentials, which always reaches threshold and produces action potentials on the sarcolemma, and that action potential then moves over the whole sarcolemma and including down into the T-tubules because you see voltage-gated channels within the T-tubules. Okay. Also within the T-tubules, there are other kinds of membrane proteins, and these, okay, are called the DHP receptors, or dihydropyridine receptors. When the voltage changes over here, it changes conformation, and this is a really interesting kind of receptor because it's connected up directly to some receptors in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and one is called a ryanodine receptor. And since they're connected to each other, when there's a conformation change in the DHP that causes a conformation change in the ryanodine receptor, this is a calcium channel. It gets pulled open, and then what does calcium do? It rushes out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right. And furthermore, there are other receptors in the sarcoplasmic reticulum that we call calcium-induced calcium release channels. So that as soon as calcium starts to leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum, the calcium-induced calcium release channels open up, and then even more calcium leaves the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so that kind of acts as a little positive feedback loop, and the diameter of the calcium-induced calcium release channels is 10 times bigger than the normal ion channels. All right, so what can you tell me about calcium leaving the sarcoplasmic reticulum when these calcium-induced calcium release channels open up? Because they're huge, how much calcium leaves? A huge amount, right? So not only is there a huge concentration gradient, but now there's a huge doorway for it to leave, and it floods over between all of the myofibrils, binding to troponin, allowing for cross bridges to cycle. So this scheme right here is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. All right, so you should understand how an action potential in a motor neuron causes the release of neurotransmitter. Don't forget that calcium channel in the synapse right here, or in the Bouton terminale, causes release of neurotransmitter, which then depolarizes the muscle cell, which then triggers an action potential down into the T-tubules. And then that activates the DHP receptors, which pulls on the ryanodine receptors, which then even activates the calcium-induced release channels, which then floods the whole myofibril with calcium. Okay. So that seems a little wordy, but I think it's important because you think that can all happen instantaneously without any time, or does that take a little time for it to happen? It takes it's almost instantaneous, but it still takes a little time for all those processes to happen in order for calcium to diffuse out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum throughout the myofibril. And I think from lab, you're kind of aware of that already. Yeah.
What
Oh, when it goes down the T-tubule. Right, so here are the voltage-gated channels that propagate the action potential, not only over the sarcolemma, but down into the T-tubules. All right, that activates the DHP receptor because these are voltage-gated channels. The DHP is a voltage-gated channel, but it just doesn't cause a change in membrane potential. It's connected to another receptor on the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And remember that the T-tubule is associated with the terminal cisternae of the sarcoplasmic reticulum because that forms a triad. They actually have to touch each other because this ryanodine receptor right here is just a mechanical receptor. It changes conformation when there is a conformation change caused in this ryanodine receptor, which is a voltage-gated receptor. All right, so think of this ryanodine receptor as just being a mechanical gate. So for instance, if that door were closed over there, let's think about how we would model this in terms of membrane transport. In order to open that door, would you have to like shock it with a battery, change the voltage on that door if you wanted to get out? That's not what happens with these voltage-gated channels, right? The voltage has to change before they open up. But if you wanted to get through that door, how would you open it up? You would just push it, right? It's just a mechanically gated door. And it's the same thing for these ryanodine receptors. Right? They don't sense a voltage. They don't respond to voltage. They just respond to something pushing and pulling on them. And what's the thing that's pushing and pulling on them? It's the DHP receptor within the T-tubule. So it kind of acts just like a door that we have in the room, which is relatively rare in biology to see this very simple mechanically coupled kind of system hooked up just like that. Okay? But the end result is what? Release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which starts cross-bridge cycling. Okay. So sometimes, and I talked about everything that's on this slide, sometimes we call this electromechanical release of calcium because the ryanodine receptor is what? Just a mechanical receptor that's getting pulled on by the DHP receptor. Okay. So here is just a nice flow chart that you should look over, but I probably don't want to read it to you because I talked about everything in here. But this is just a synopsis of what I said. Okay, and this is what we call excitation-contraction coupling. The signal comes from a somatic motor neuron. What does somatic again mean? What does it mean again? It means just voluntary as opposed to autonomic, right? Okay. That acetylcholine, because the axon terminus of a somatic motor neuron is extensive, it always causes a depolarization, right, a graded potential which is sufficient to reach threshold, and so an action potential is always produced on a muscle cell. So a muscle cell can, as a matter of fact, a skeletal muscle cell can never decide if it's going to contract or not contract, right? As soon as a somatic motor neuron reaches the axon terminal, that skeletal muscle is going to contract. It's always coupled to contraction, okay? Because those nicotinic receptors don't produce, in any case, they never produce an IPSP. It's always, what, 100% EPSP. And it's sufficient in magnitude to cause an action potential. Okay. Now, what about muscle relaxation? How does that happen? Well, okay, when an action potential dies away, then the ryanodine receptor is not pulling on the calcium, or the DHP receptor is not pulling on the ryanodine receptor. That closes the calcium channels. And there are calcium pumps that are always working within the sarcoplasmic reticulum membrane. And a pump is doing what? Moving calcium from the myofibril back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And when that calcium signal goes away, it pulls calcium off of troponin. Tropomyosin covers up the binding sites for myosin again, and the muscle can no longer contract, and so then it relaxes. Okay, due to those ATPases in the sarcoplasmic reticulum. All right, so let's look at some characteristics of muscle contraction a little bit. Unless somebody has a question. Anybody got a question about excitation-contraction coupling? So a good place to start with that is to make sure you understand, right, the anatomy of a sarcomere and a muscle fiber, right? Okay, and then just trace it through. All right, so here we have a diagram or a tracing of a muscle twitch. And a muscle twitch is the tension that's developed versus time. All right, so this is not like an electrocardiogram or what you did in lab, because you measured the electrical activity from muscle cells, but this is actually measuring the force or the tension that's being developed by a muscle when it's stimulated into contraction. And you could stimulate it electrically if you wanted. Now in lab, did you stimulate any muscles electrically? Or yeah, you did. You actually hooked up an electrode, or did you measure with electrodes? I got a feeling you just measured, but you didn't feel anything to cause a contraction. Okay. Well, we need to improve that lab a little bit. It'd be nice to hook you up to electrodes to develop this kind of graph right here. But so what I don't see on this graph, all right, is the stimulus. Okay, is the stimulus. But oh, you did a simulation though, where you could stimulate a imaginary muscle inside the computer. Okay, so let's just say the stimulus would occur right by the cursor at this point in time, because this is a time axis. So the stimulus occurred right here, and then there's a period of time when what is happening? It looks like, in terms of tension, it looks like nothing is going on, but you know what is happening. Excitation-contraction coupling is happening, right? And then calcium floods into the myofibril, and what happens to the actin and myosin filaments? They start to slide over each other, and then tension is developed. And then when the stimulation goes away, calcium is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum, and what happens to the muscle cell? It starts to relax, and that's what we call a muscle twitch. So there is a period of time from when the muscle is stimulated to when it contracts, and you guys had to know that in lab. What is that period of time called? And that is called the latent period, the time between stimulation and when the muscle actually starts to develop tension. And why is that? Why is that? Why does a muscle cell have latent period? Because the action potential has to travel down into the T-tubules. That's relatively fast, right? But then the DHP receptors got to pull on the ryanodine receptors. That takes a little time. That's got to induce the calcium release channels. That takes a little bit more time. Calcium has got to diffuse out of the sarcoplasmic reticulum around all the myofibrils and myofilaments. It's got to bind to troponin. Tropomyosin's got to get out of the way, right? The head group's got to attach to actin. And guess that takes a little time to do all that, right? So excitation-contraction coupling produces that latent period. Okay, so this is not like an action potential, because what can you tell me about an action potential? It is all or none, right? But it is constant. Action potentials everywhere in your body are basically the same height, the same amplitude, the same width, all right? But what can you tell me about these, what we call twitches? Do they look identical, the first one compared to the second one right here? They don't look identical, okay? So twitches can actually summate. All right, so if we stimulate this muscle again before it is completely relaxed, so if we stimulate it again, maybe like right about here, then we have a latent period, and then the muscle starts to contract again, it contracts with a higher degree of force. And why is that? Well, it's because the amount of tension that can be developed is directly related to the amount of calcium that is still left over around the myofibrils. And not all the calcium has been pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum yet, so that when another excitation comes along, right, the calcium that is released is added to whatever is left over, and that causes an increase in tension. So that's what we would call summation. So a muscle fiber does want to contract to its full ability every time, but that is just related to how much calcium is available to move tropomyosin out of the way. All right, so you should see that the second twitch is always at a higher level compared to the first twitch, and we call that summation. So contractions can vary with strength, but we call these graded contractions. And that's basically just due to the amount of calcium that is inside the muscle cell. All right, and that is dependent on the frequency of stimulation. All right, so for instance, let's look at a muscle with three different regimes of stimulation by changing the frequency of stimulation, maybe 5 shocks per second. We can see that a muscle contracts, but before it's fully relaxed, it is stimulated once again. So So at this point in time, not all the calcium, of course, is pumped back into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then we open up the sarcoplasmic reticulum even more. Once again, more calcium leaves, right? And so the muscle starts to develop tension again. And before it relaxes, right, that same process occurs. So it starts to develop tension. And it just walks up this plateau of tension. Right? So this is when a muscle is contracted without completely relaxing. That's what we call tetanus. So muscles, skeletal muscles, or I need to qualify that, skeletal muscles can go into tetany. They can contract without relaxing. Right? And if we increase the frequency of stimulation to the muscle, notice that we cut down the time that it goes into that relaxation phase. So now it looks what? More constant. And calcium is just building up inside the cell, but it finally reaches a plateau where no more calcium can leave the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And then the third case over here, if we increase the frequency of stimulation even more and prevent any kind of relaxation to take place, so now we're flooding the sarcolemma with action potentials maximally, that is causing maximal release of calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticulum. The muscle cell can't relax at all. This is what we call complete tetanus. All right, and then if we keep a muscle in contraction, in complete tetanus for a certain period of time, what's going to happen to the tension that's being developed by that muscle? It's going to start to decrease. Okay, even though you might want that muscle to contract, it's going to fatigue because a couple things are happening inside the muscle. All right, when a muscle contracts, it turns into a solid. All right, and if it's a solid structure, what about blood supply to a muscle when it turns into like a tabletop? Blood can't get into that muscle, and what's in blood that muscle needs in order for it to contract? Oxygen, right? So without oxygen, there's no oxidative phosphorylation. So what happens to the metabolism inside that muscle cell? Okay. ATP concentration is going to decrease, ADP concentration and inorganic phosphate concentration is going to increase. There's another compound that's going to increase because you're going from an aerobic muscle to an anaerobic muscle, and so lactic acid is going to build up as well. So the decrease in ATP, the increase of ADP, inorganic phosphate, and lactic acid is going to inhibit muscle contraction. Right at that molecular level, cross-bridge cycling, because when lactic acid builds up, the pH of the muscle changes, and it's going to change the chemistry of the muscle. Even the muscle just won't be able to contract anymore, and fatigue sets in. Okay. Now, what can you tell me about this decreasing slope right here of this tetanus plateau when fatigue is taking place? Did you ever have a muscle go into tetanus? Nobody in here? Have you ever been walking around and all of a sudden get a cramp in a muscle? What does it do? It just contracts, like maximally. And is that really cool? Like if I had a cramp in my biceps, would I walk around and say, oh, look at that big cool muscle right there? What would I be doing? I wouldn't be showing it off, right? I'd be singing, praying, dancing, or doing anything to get that cramp to go away. Because why? Because it hurts like hell, right? It hurts really bad, really, really bad. So anytime you cause a muscle to go into fatigue, especially when it's in tetanus right here, it hurts like hell. And when people have blood supply blocked off to their heart, can the heart just relax? Can it ever take a break? No, it's got to keep working, but it doesn't have oxygen, right? It goes into that fatigue state as well, so it's going to not pump blood as well. But how does that feel for an individual that's having a heart attack? It hurts like hell too, right? Just like a muscle cramp. And it's a different kind of pain. That's a visceral pain. As a matter of fact, the pain of having a heart attack could be so bad that that will actually cause somebody to give up their enthusiasm for life, and they'll die just because the pain is so bad, right? And they might actually recover from a heart attack if it weren't for all that anxiety and their understanding of what a massive traumatic event that's happening inside their body. So if you ever are with anybody that's having a heart attack, what do? You scream, oh my God, you're having a heart attack, you're going to die? No, absolutely not, because that might be enough to actually kill the person, right? So when somebody's going through that episode, you just have to be very supportive, right, and tell them to relax and breathe, and we're going to get you to a hospital right away, and maybe you can come home tomorrow, right? So I don't know if that's going to be true or not, but that's what you have to tell people, and you'll be a really big help. You might actually save somebody's life just by saying something like that. Okay? So remember, when muscle or different parts of your body can't get oxygen, how does it feel?
Hurts.
Yeah, it hurts like hell, right? It hurts really, really bad. Yeah.
When a person's getting a heart attack and they get that pain on the left side, is that attributed to the fact that the left side of the heart is where oxygen is flooded actually?
Oh, it doesn't. I don't think it has much to do with the circulatory pattern, but there are nociceptors, there are pain receptors in the heart, but they're visceral receptors, so you don't have the same sensation from your heart that you do on the surface of your body. Okay, so somatic sensation on the surface of your body, when those nociceptors get stimulated, it's a very acute kind of pain, right? And the kind of pain you experience in your body is what we call visceral. It's very diffuse, but it's just general. It's still as severe, it's just more general. And maybe somebody has gone through childbirth or had an appendicitis or a gallbladder stone or something like that, or kidney stone, they know what visceral pain feels like. It's just a totally different kind of pain. It's very dull and aching, but the magnitude can be even more impressive than an acute pain on the surface of your body. And the other thing, visceral pain is referred. So since you don't usually experience visceral pain, you don't really have an appreciation of where it's coming from in your body. So your mind just makes up a place to put where that pain is coming from. So the very easy place to put that pain is in your left shoulder and your left arm, because it's associated with pain nerve endings that come from your left arm. That's where it enters your... Huh? I can't quite hear you.
Jaw pain?
Jaw pain. Ah, jaw pain. It's not ringing a bell, but it's something I probably forgot about. Okay. Yeah. Oh, what causes a muscle spasm? You know, it could be maybe an imbalance in electrolytes. Everybody says potassium might cause, a decrease in potassium might cause that. Damage to a skeletal muscle, if you've been working out, for instance, can cause a muscle to go into spasm. And various higher centers in our mind, if we're experiencing a lot of stress, we'll just have overall increase in muscle tone in our bodies, and that can maybe even trigger a muscle to go into spasm. And maybe another thing would be different drugs too, like caffeine, for instance, which is stimulatory. That can cause muscle spasms. So some people actually get little muscle spasms in their eyelids, their palpebrae, or they get a muscle spasm of a little stapedius muscle in their ear, and it will go like thump, 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 thump all day long. So could be or combinations of any of those things. Yeah. Yeah, it's good to know about, because you just really don't want any of those things happening. Yeah. So tetanus, okay, that we're producing right here is caused by stimulation, by electrical shocks, okay? And so when you have tetanus occurring in a muscle, it could be due to those things that I just talked about, maybe too much caffeine or maybe inappropriate exercise to that muscle or not replenishing your fluids or electrolytes or other kinds of toxins that produce, like botulism toxin produces tetanus. Okay, and then it's going to kill the muscle, actually. Or, actually, there's another, I misspoke. It's not botulism. It's not botulism toxin. It's a tetanus toxin from a bacteria. I'll have to look at it. I can't really talk about it right exactly now. But before we go, I do want to mention one other thing. So again, when a muscle goes into contraction, how does it feel? Hurts like hell, because oxygen is not getting to that tissue, produces lactic acid. There's a medical condition when somebody's blood can't carry oxygen. All right, so none of the tissues in their body are receiving oxygen. Can you imagine how that feels all over their body? It hurts like hell. Where? All over your body, right? And that condition is due to a genetically inherited condition where hemoglobin isn't produced correctly. So hemoglobin under certain circumstances doesn't carry oxygen. And that's called sickle cell disease, right? And so the blood cells turn into, from a nice round structure to kind of pointed, and it gets stuck in very small blood vessels, doesn't deliver oxygen. And so how does a person feel when they're in sickle cell crisis? Oh, it hurts like hell everywhere, all their arms, their legs, all right? That's terrible. What do we do for patients that experience this intractable pain all over their body, or even in one place of their body? What do we have to, how do, can we help them? Opiates, right? To take that pain away, because there's no reason why those people should be experiencing that kind of pain. And so when somebody has that genetic disorder, guess what happens? They have that their whole life. And so what do they need their whole life, basically, when they go into crisis? One of the things are opiates, right? So you might be seeing some patients that come back to you time and time and time again that might be asking for pain medication or opiates. And what is one of the first things that pops into your mind when you bump into somebody? Could he be a friend of yours or whatever that says, oh, I need some opiates. I need some opiates. I need some opiates. Okay, you think of them as being what? A drug seeker. And when you know they're a drug seeker, right, not only are you concerned about them, but you are concerned about yourself, because you may not ever know what they're going to do for opiates, right, if they're a drug seeker. But if somebody is suffering from sickle cell disease, are they a drug seeker? No, they have an underlying medical condition, right, that needs treatment, and they need your medical opinion and proper treatment. Don't treat them like somebody that should be in chemical dependency, right? They have an organic underlying disease that you should be very compassionate about and treat properly, because it's nothing that they can do to help themselves except they're coming to you for help, right? So please don't treat them like a drug seeker or anybody else that has what an underlying condition that produces pain that they can't do anything about, right? It's two different classes of patients. All right, so don't forget, it what hurts like hell when you're having a heart attack, when you're in sickle cell crisis. All right, sickle cell crisis is all over your body, but it's not just muscle. What else is actually dying in a patient that has sickle cell disease? Their kidneys are dying, their brain, their heart, right? Everything is dying. So it's a really terrible disease to have. The bends produces sort of a similar condition, but they're little micro blocks because of nitrogen bubbles that build up in the blood. Okay. Yeah. So how does it feel maybe when a uterus goes into contraction? Probably hurts like hell too.